Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, newly empowered House Republicans take aim at the IRS and what they call government overreach as their first orders of business.
The Biden White House proposes more student loan relief while plans to cancel some of the debt are held up in court.
And Navy veteran Mark Frerich shares what his newfound freedom means to him after being held hostage in Afghanistan.
If I don't let this thing go, it's going to just keep festering and festering. I got to just let it out, let it go.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Nature is still throwing everything it has at California tonight. More than a foot of rain, 4 to 5 feet of snow, severe floods, and mudslides. Pacific storms have battered the state for 10 days now, claiming at least 15 lives.
The storms have left untold property damage and left many thousands of customers with no power. Stephanie Tsai reports on the ongoing ordeal.
Scenes of destruction are unfolding across many parts of California. A tree sliding down a hillside and onto a highway in the Santa Cruz Mountains. A man paddling through flooded streets in Santa Barbara County. And homes crushed by trees in Sacramento. Residents like Camilla Schaefer in the mountain town of Felton said the water rose rapidly.
It was rising about 2 feet per hour. We experienced this on New Year's Eve, so we kind of had our markers for, you know, sort of 22 feet. It kept on rising, and it did get quite scary.
The entire town of Montecito, a wealthy enclave in Santa Barbara County, was forced to evacuate or shelter in place. Earlier yesterday, officials raised concerns about the increasing potential for a major mudslide.
The community is at risk for a second debris flow from the Thomas Fire Burn Scar. We're taking this risk so seriously that we have more than 200 responders, rescuers pre-positioned in our community, ready for that event.
The Thomas Fire left a massive burn scar that led to a deadly mudslide almost exactly 5 years ago, a tragedy on many residents' minds this week, including celebrity Ellen DeGeneres.
This is crazy. On the five-year anniversary, we're having unprecedented rain.
Some miles down the coast, more evacuations were ordered in Ventura County, where rescuers aided a trapped homeless community out of the dangerous waters with ladders and helicopters. Not everyone could be saved. In San Luis Obispo County, the floodwaters were so powerful rescuers had to call off the search for a five-year-old boy swept away from his mother. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
Yet another storm arrives tomorrow with forecasts of heavy new downpours.
President Biden and the leaders of Mexico and Canada held wide-ranging talks in Mexico City today on trade, climate change, and more. They pledged to build prosperity across the hemisphere, even as they face divisions over how to regulate the flow of migrants. The atmosphere appeared less tense than last night when Mexico's president complained that the U.S. had abandoned Latin America. In Brazil today, police questioned hundreds of people detained after rioters stormed the Capitol complex in Brasilia on Sunday. In all, some 1,500 people were in custody. Late Monday, pro-democracy protesters rallied in Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, waving flags and demanding no amnesty for the rioters.
These people have to be punished. The bosses have to be punished. Those who are giving money have to be punished. Brazil is much bigger than what they showed there. Those people do not represent Brazil. We represent Brazil.
The rioters supported defeated President Jair Bolsonaro and demanded the ouster of the new government. Russian forces are intensifying attacks in eastern Ukraine, escalating already savage fighting. Reports today indicated Russians have captured most of the town of Soledar, trying to cut off the key city of Bakhmut in Donetsk province. Ukrainian officials said artillery, mortars, and rocket fire have laid waste to the area. They said the Russian strategy is to reduce whole cities to rubble. The World Health Organization today urged countries to recommend that passengers resume wearing masks on long-distance flights. That came as a new subvariant of COVID-19 is spreading. In the U.S., it's now accounting for more than a quarter of new cases. The WHO also recommends a return to pre-flight testing. Meanwhile, two Democrats in the House of Representatives here in the U.S. filed an ethics complaint against freshman Republican George Santos of New York. He's acknowledged lying about his background and education. The complaint raises questions about his finances. Congressman Daniel Goldman and Richie Torres pressed GOP leaders to back an investigation.
We haven't seen a single movement on the part of Republican leadership. They have not commented on this publicly. They have not condemned George Santos and all of his lies.
The number two House Republican, Steve Scalise, said GOP leaders are handling the matter internally. He gave no specifics. The Trump Organization's former chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, was sentenced today to 5 months in jail. He pleaded guilty to tax fraud in New York and was ordered to pay nearly $2 million in taxes and penalties. Weisselberg has testified that Mr. Trump knew nothing about his scheme to dodge taxes on executive perks. And on Wall Street, stocks advanced ahead of a government report this week on December inflation. Major indices were up 0.5% to 1%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 186 points to close at 33,704. The Nasdaq rose 107 points. The S&P 500 added 27. Still to come on the NewsHour, what we know about the potentially classified documents found at President Biden's former office. Advances in artificial intelligence raise new ethics concerns. Folk and electronica singer Beth Orton on creating what's considered to be her best work yet, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
After a tumultuous start to its term, the Republican-led House is targeting its biggest priorities.
Today, GOP lawmakers started work on their top agenda items and launched key subcommittees that would focus on China as well as investigations into the Biden administration. Republican Whip Tom Emmer was optimistic about what's in store.
This is a great time to be a Republican in Washington, D.C. in the House, because you have a chance to make a difference and you have a chance to be part of a great team that is going to work together. And I think you saw that starting to happen last week. Have we arrived? No, not yet. We'll continue to get better at this together.
Following all of this closely is Washington Post reporter Leanne Caldwell. Leanne, welcome to the NewsHour. In the new Republican-led House, they used their first vote to claw back some $70 billion in new funding for the IRS that was signed into law last year, the House GOP fulfilling a major campaign promise expected to die in the Democratic-led Senate. Help us understand more about the GOP's priorities in this new Congress.
Hey, Jeff. So there's a couple things. What they're going to be doing publicly on the floor of the House of Representatives are some of their priorities, and also what's going on behind the scenes. As far as publicly, in addition to that scaling back of IRS funding, there's also going to be a series of votes on abortion to limit federal funding of abortion and condemning attacks on pro-life entities. And so you can see that those cultural issues are going to be very important for them. And then behind the scenes, all these agreements that were made over the past week or so are really focused on cutting back government spending. That is going to be a huge priority for Republicans, given the influence of the far right in this Congress, Jeff.
The House also voted to establish new select committees, one focused on investigations, another focused on U.S. competition with China, which might be an area where there could be some bipartisan cooperation. Tell us more about how these committees have come together and what I understand is a fight about who will sit on congressional committees moving forward.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's kind of a contrast, these two committees that both the formation of them passed the House just tonight. The one on the weaponization of the federal government, that's going to be led by conservative firebrand, Jim Jordan. That passed along party lines, and that is going to be a very political and polarizing committee where Republicans are going to focus on the, what they say is overreach of the FBI and the Department of Justice. Meanwhile, you have this committee on China that actually passed with bipartisan support. It's going to be led by Representative Mike Gallagher, someone who is respected among Democrats. And China is a big political issue, and no one in Congress wants to look weak on China. So this could be an area of bipartisan cooperation, Jeff.
What about immigration, Leanne? President Biden visited the southern border on Sunday. He's there talking about a whole host of issues to include immigration with the leaders of Canada and Mexico. Immigration has been talked about a lot on the Hill, but we've seen precious little in terms of policy lately. Might that change?
You're absolutely right. Not a lot has been done in two decades or more on immigration. Well, there's a couple different dynamics that are happening. In addition to President Biden going to the border, which is a huge sign, this is the first time, that this is going to be a big political issue leading into the 2024 election as well. He has to show like he's trying to do something about what is happening at the border. Meanwhile, you have a bipartisan group of senators who are also at the border today. They are moving forward on bipartisan legislation that tackles border security, but also addresses the Dreamers, these children who came to the United States. But then you have the House of Representatives who are moving in a very hard-line direction. They don't want to have anything to do with the Dreamers at this point. They want to secure the border. So all these different dynamics are going to come head-on, and we don't know if any of them are going to become law, Jeff.
Leanne, in the 45 seconds or so we have left, now that Congress is getting to work, has the heat let up at all on Kevin McCarthy, given the way the rules are? Any one of his critics could issue a vote of no confidence.
We'll have to see. Because of the threat of that vote, Kevin McCarthy has a lot of pressure that he has to follow this agreement that he reached with these hard right members. And if he messes up, then they will could deploy that. And so they have gotten, now they're doing the easy stuff. Well, electing a speaker was supposed to be easy. It wasn't. Now they're doing the messaging bills, the things that the party agrees on. But when it gets to funding the government, government spending, it's going to be a lot more difficult, Jeff.
Leanne Caldwell of The Washington Post. Leanne, thanks so much. Good to see you.
One item House Republicans are adding to their list of priorities, investigating a small number of potentially classified documents discovered at a private office that President Biden used after he was vice president. Incoming Intelligence Committee Chair Mike Turner wrote to the Director of National Intelligence today and called for a damage assessment into the documents and, quote, potential violation of laws. To help us understand what this means, I'm joined by Mark Zaid, an attorney who focuses on national security issues. Mark, welcome back. There's a number of questions here. I want to begin, though, with the timeline. We know, according to the White House, Biden's personal attorney found the documents while packing up and moving these files. They immediately notified the National Archives, handed them over the next day. This was all back in November. Should they have disclosed this back in November when it happened?
Well, there was no legal requirement for them to have done so. Just as with Trump and Mar-a-Lago, we, the public, didn't know about the situation there for quite an extensive amount of time until someone in both cases basically leaked the information to the media to run a story. One could possibly argue that perhaps the oversight committees in Congress should have been notified in both instances, but I don't think that happened with either case. But overall, no, it's not that surprising.
Well, unsurprisingly as well, the revelation was immediately met with criticism from Republicans, comparing this incident with, of course, as you mentioned, former President Trump having classified documents at his Florida estate. Here is just what a few members, Republican members of Congress had to say.
There's a true two-tier justice system stemming from Merrick Garland's Department of Justice.
Those classified documents were known before the election and was intentionally concealed to the Americans. I think that's wrong.
Now, ironic, I know Joe Biden was quick to criticize President Trump for mistakenly taking some documents that were apparently classified.
Mark Zaid, when you look at what happened with former President Trump and what's unfolding now, are the two circumstances comparable?
Other than from the very, very beginning, when there was the disclosure or finding of classified information, and even then, it's really different because the U.S. government had to go after President Trump rather than the U.S. government being notified by President Biden's lawyers and the National Archives of this fact, of what happened. They're incredibly different. Now, look, as a legal matter, anytime there's classified information that is found that should not be where it is, that's significant. And apparently there was some very sensitive information in this, and there'll be a very serious investigation by a former Trump, by a Trump-appointed U.S. attorney, one of only two who remains, to look into this. And apparently by press reports, that's almost finished. But the circumstances are so completely different. Immediately, as you mentioned, President Biden's lawyers notified the White House, who notified the National Archives, who retrieved the documents right away. Now, we'll see where the facts lead. But in the Mar-a-Lago case, there was a repeated effort for almost a year and a half to get Donald Trump to turn over those documents. And it was only after multiple attempts to retrieve them and the execution of a search warrant, because there were lies that were stated to the administration to recover this. And now there's factual evidence that Donald Trump himself was hiding and obstructing the investigation. Very, very different facts, at least from what we know as of now.
Do you agree there needs to be some kind of damage assessment, as Congressman Turner has suggested?
Yes, that absolutely. And that would be common. Now, I will say it is very common that mishandling of classified information occurs. Unfortunately, individuals mistakenly take home documents for work, or they retire and they pack up their office, and then 5 years later they find them in their garage or attic. And mostly this is always handled administratively. It is really rare where some criminal penalty happens if there's not actual espionage or egregious hoarding of classified information. But there always should be a damage assessment. We have to see who accessed these files. How did they get there? Were they kept in that locked closet, apparently? But did anyone, as I said, get access to them? So that would be common, and I would expect the House and Senate Intelligence Committees will receive a damage assessment at some point, particularly after the U.S. attorney finishes his investigation.
Mark, in just the minute or so we have left, there is that ongoing DOJ probe, a special counsel appointed by Attorney General Merrick Garland to look into Mr. Trump's handling of those documents. Does this revelation about the Biden documents have any potential impact on that investigation?
Legally, it should not. Politically, is a completely different creature. As you've seen by the clips that you aired, this is and has been seized by the Republicans and will continue to be. And what concerns me the most is that, frankly, the average American is not probably going to be able to understand the difference between the two cases. They'll think President Biden, classified records at his office. President Trump, classified records at his home. But the reality is these cases are so vastly different.
Mark Zaid, always good to talk to you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
The Biden White House has released a new student loan plan that would lower monthly payments for millions of borrowers and pause them completely for some. There's been a freeze on loan repayments throughout the pandemic, but that's coming to an end in June. The new proposal allows borrowers earning less than $30,600 annually to pause payments altogether. The ambitious plan also proposes reducing payments on undergraduate loans to 5% of discretionary income, and it would cancel student debt 10 years earlier for certain borrowers. But the total cost is one of the many crucial questions. NPR education correspondent Corey Turner broke this story and joins us now. Corey, it's good to see you. The White House is moving forward with this proposal that President Biden first announced this past summer, but it was really overshadowed by his sweeping plan to eliminate thousands of dollars of federal student loan debt for people who qualify. How does this income-driven repayment plan work?
Yeah, it's really interesting, Jeff, because if you think about the difference between the president's broad debt relief plan and the income-driven repayment plan they just unveiled, it's the latter that will arguably help more borrowers looking forward into the future. This new plan would do a few things. As you mentioned before, it would, for borrowers who earn less than $30,000 a year, they'd be allowed to basically make $0 monthly payments on their loans. Also, for borrowers who take out relatively small loans, we're talking about $12,000 or less, they qualify for forgiveness after 10 years instead of the current 20 years. Also, maybe most importantly, Jeff, is something that I've heard about for a long time with old income-driven repayment plans, where you're making small monthly payments, but interest is exploding. Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen under this new plan. So there's a lot here for borrowers, especially lower income borrowers, to like.
And income is the only requirement. I mean, who's eligible? And generally speaking, how much would someone's payment decrease under this new plan?
Well, I think the largest decrease would be for undergraduate borrowers. There's a real preference in here for undergraduate borrowers. It would basically, according to the Ed Department, cut their monthly loan payments in half. And that's basically because of a new way, a lower threshold for calculating discretionary income. The old rule would apply for graduate school borrowers. The plan would be open to, I believe, the vast majority of new and even current borrowers. There's one pretty large exception, and that is family members, caregivers who have what are called Parent Plus loans.
So as all of this is unfolding, happening sort of on a parallel track, is the president's plan to forgive up to $20,000 in student debt. A group of Republican governors challenged that forgiveness plan. It's headed to the Supreme Court. Give us a status update on that.
We're now basically waiting. It's in the hands of the Supreme Court. We know oral arguments will happen sometime next month, and we assume we'll get a decision by late May, early June. And in the meantime, we wait. And we do know, though, this is important for borrowers to know, the administration and the Education Department have released a timetable for a return to repayment. Because whatever the Supreme Court decides here, millions of federal student loan borrowers will still have loans left over that they will need to begin repaying this year.
So, Corey, if the Supreme Court finds that President Biden's debt relief plan is legal, it means, as I understand it, that the president's student debt proposal since August of 2022 would increase deficits by at least $600 billion over a decade. And you reported this morning that there were some Education Department officials who were surprised. Others were angry about this new proposal because it leaves them scrambling to find hundreds of millions of dollars to cut from other programs.
Yeah, this is the thing to remember, Jeff, about implementing both the president's debt relief plan, but also everything else that the Office for Federal Student Aid has to do. It's got lots of things, from revamping the federal student aid form that families have to fill out. It's got to sign new contracts with servicers, public service loan forgiveness program improvements. And so there are the big costs, and then there are the much smaller but still really important costs of how do you implement this program? And what I found is the Office for Federal Student Aid is suddenly in a budget crisis, and it's having to scale back many of its efforts for 2023 when it comes to rolling out these programs, sustaining them, because it just can't afford it all.
NPR education correspondent Corey Turner, thanks again.
You're welcome, Jeff.
The last 8 years have been the hottest recorded in human history. That's according to the European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service. And with planet warming emissions on the rise, scientists worry about melting glaciers and the onslaught of repercussions. A new study published in the Journal of Science looks at the future of hundreds of thousands of glaciers and what we can expect. To explain the findings and what they mean for the planet, I'm joined by David Rounce, Assistant Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering for Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Professor, welcome, and thanks for joining us. Your study looks at the world's more than 214,000 glaciers. You looked at what happens even if the world manages to meet what is its most ambitious global warming goal, right? Just a 1.5 degrees Celsius increase. What did your study find happens to those glaciers if we can do that?
We found that if we limit the temperature increase relative to pre-industrial levels to 1.5 degrees Celsius, that we'll lose approximately a quarter of the glaciers by mass. The glaciers' contributions to sea level rise will be approximately 90 millimeters, and we will lose about 50% of the glaciers by number.
What's the timeline for that? When do you expect that to happen by?
Over the next century. So we modeled from 2015 to 2100 for various temperature change scenarios.
Even with that very conservative modeling estimate, you had nearly half of all those glaciers, over 100,000 of them, you said, would disappear by the end of the century. What would that mean for sea level rise, for example?
So most of the glaciers that will be lost completely are smaller. So out of those 215,000 glaciers, the majority of the glaciers are very small. They're still important for water resources, for culture, spirituality, especially for high mountain communities. But when we think about sea level rise, it's really the largest glacierized regions that are the most important. And there will be ice remaining by the end of the century in those different regions.
You mentioned the importance, especially when it comes to water supply. Explain that to us a little bit. I don't know that most people know about that. How important are those glaciers to communities around the world?
So these glaciers are located in the high mountain regions, and they act as a reservoir of fresh water. These are in areas such as Central Europe, high mountain Asia, Alaska, Western Canada, where there are also large populations located nearby. In high mountain Asia alone, there are over a billion people who rely on these freshwater resources from the glaciers. And so any changes to the glacier runoff that's available downstream means that those communities need to seek freshwater resources elsewhere, either from groundwater, or they would need to build reservoirs in order to have a similar capacity as to what's provided by the glaciers right now.
How much of this is inevitable? In other words, in your modeling, I mean, are there actions that you find in your studies that we could or should be taking that would help to slow this down or stop it or reverse it? Or is this a matter of when rather than if?
That's a great question. And that's one of the things we tried to focus on. As I mentioned, right now, the temperature change increase based off of current pledges is estimated to be around 2.7 degrees. So there's a lot that we can do to reduce our carbon emissions and bring that temperature change increase down to a degree and a half. And if we do that, we can save about 20% of the glaciers by number, and we can save about 8% of the glaciers by mass. And we reduce the glacier's contributions to sea level rise by about 25 millimeters. So we can really have a big impact if we're able to reduce the temperature increase in the future. And that's something that we should be hopeful about. However, there is the inevitable cause of this glacier mass loss that glaciers are responding to changes in temperature that have occurred over the last several decades. The response times of glaciers can be very long. And so even if we were to stop the temperature increase right now, we still have an amount of committed mass loss that's going to occur regardless.
Professor, I know you study this, and we're talking a lot about percentages and mass and so on, but if you could just put it into context for us, when you're talking about a loss on this scale that seems very close to inevitable, how devastating is that for the planet?
It is devastating. We really focused a lot on trying to understand the differences in these temperature change scenarios. But one of the things that we found, for example, is that between a degree and a half, 2 degrees, and 3 degrees, a lot of regions around the world are very sensitive to changes, such that with 3 degrees in the contiguous United States and Western Canada and Central Europe, those regions will experience near complete deglaciation, meaning all of the glaciers will be lost in those regions. While if we limit the temperature increase to 2 degrees or a degree and a half, will at least preserve some of the ice in those regions.
Professor David Rounce from Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh joining us tonight. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
In the coming weeks and months, we're going to be exploring the newest developments in artificial intelligence and how it's changing the way we live and work. Stephanie Tsai kicks off our periodic series, The AI Frontier, with a look at some new tools that are getting attention and sparking concern over their ability to produce original work, ranging from college-level essays to art.
A chat box that can mimic human intelligence and create poetry? I had to try it.
Write a haiku about a tabby cat.
Here's what came back. Soft fur brushed by breeze. Tabby cat basks in the sun, purrs of contentment. Not bad. There's also an image generator that can compose and manipulate pictures with a few keywords. A tabby cat sleeping on the beach, wearing a fedora as an oil pastel. A site that writes and debugs programming code for you. Or a video generating tool.
Hi, I'm Anna. I'm an AI avatar created entirely by artificial intelligence. Today we're going to...
It's the rise of generative AI, a branch of artificial intelligence that enables computer programs to create original content.
Let's see how good of a college essay ChatGPT can write.
This tool from the San Francisco-based company OpenAI is ChatGPT and can write essays.
Take a look at a couple of these sentences. Starting from the top, computer science has always been a fascinating field to me from the moment I first learned about computers.
And children's books. Last month, design manager Amar Reshi used ChatGPT and text-to-image program Midjourney to create his book, Alice and Sparkle. Here's how it works. To create new content, these programs are trained on datasets of existing content that hold text, images, video files, or even code scraped from the internet. Some artists say this amounts to appropriating their work without permission.
I do hyperrealistic drawings.
Including South African artist Jonah Dry.
This scares me. It makes a huge part of my practice somewhat redundant.
Hey artists, if you've been wondering if AI has been using your art to train itself, I figured out where to look.
Illustrator Carly Ann Tipsy suggested artists go to the site haveibeentrained.com to see if their artwork was used in training popular text-to-image programs.
I personally found my book cover on there and a lot of stuff from some of my favorite artists.
And last month, artists protested the portfolio site ArtStation for featuring AI-generated art on its page.
This new wave of sophisticated AI tools is raising some tricky ethical questions, as well as some big concerns about topics such as the future of human labor. For more on some of these ramifications, I'm joined by Kelsey Piper. She's a senior reporter at Vox News who covers artificial intelligence. Kelsey Piper, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour. I know this is a tricky topic, but what strikes me as the most new about some of these AI platforms is that we're no longer just talking about artificial intelligence. We seem to be talking about artificial imagination. Is that how you see this new breakthrough?
Yeah, I think a few years ago, there was something a lot of people would say about AI, which is maybe they will replace some machines and automation and learn how to do lots of manual work that humans can do, but they'll never write poetry. They'll never play great chess. They'll never tell good stories. And so one of the things that's been astonishing about the recent breakthroughs in AIs is that long before AI has learned how to clean out a toilet or put together a fast food order, it has figured out how to write poetry, how to draw beautiful artwork, how to riff off Shakespeare. It's not the direction many people expected AI to take.
And I think it's created a lot of anxiety. Is that what you sense when you talk to artists and people who feel that their work is somehow being not only appropriated, but threatened, even replaced?
So I think that any industry that sees itself start to be automated is going to be sort of appalled and frustrated at people losing good jobs that were able to support them being replaced with computers. But I think a couple things have made it worse. One of those is just that it's happened so fast. We went from having no AIs that could do meaningful, beautiful images to having a ton of them from different companies, including some open source ones that anybody could go online and play with at any time, you know, for free or for a very small price. So that's just an overnight shift. And then I think the other thing is that artists take pride in their craft. They don't think of it as just a job. They think of it as like an expression of their individuality and their style and who they are as people. And so, of course, it's a little galling to have an AI system that can just do it all and copy your style without any need for you.
This application, this tool that's been created, ChatGPT, as you say, it's gotten incredibly popular incredibly fast. Who's using it? Is it just people having fun? Or are there real world ramifications? I mean, for example, does it become irrelevant to be able to write a college essay now?
Yeah, so I think the college essay is certainly in trouble because ChatGPT can put together, I would say it is not quite at the peak of human ability yet. It is not yet writing something that is like as great as a talented human who's dedicated and working hard. But it can write something as good as your average 18-year-old who's kind of phoning it in a little bit. And that means that it is you know, writing things that are indistinguishable from many college student essays. And that has a lot of professors sort of reeling and asking themselves, how do we do assignments that aren't going to be trivially cheated on?
You know, what struck me when I tried ChatGPT is that it can do the uniquely, what I thought was a uniquely human thing of BSing. and I mean, a serious question though, what does its sophistication and its ability to do that say about the future of AI and what we're looking at?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because the key thing here is that 4 or 5 years ago, people were first coming out with the earliest language models using these generative techniques that could produce text. And they weren't very good. They were kind of stilted. They were maybe writing at like a middle school level, not a college level. They would make up a lot of stuff, and they didn't seem to have a good way of telling whether the things they were saying were true. And over the course of just a couple of years, we have vastly improved the quality of these programs. And now they're writing at a college level, and they're clever, and they bluff, and they make things up, but they can also be pretty accurate when they're prompted to be pretty accurate. So where is that taking us? In a few years, you know, maybe we do have something that replaces my job as a journalist. Maybe we do have systems that can tell you what you want to hear in incredibly convincing length at any time. And then there's the question of who decides what those AI systems tell everybody, and how do we train those AI systems such that they are, you know, on humanity's side, helping us understand the world better, instead of, right now, I would argue they're kind of trained to appease us. They're trained to say what they think we want to hear. And there's something scary about the idea of introducing these immensely powerful, immensely persuasive systems to the world with a mandate that's as limited as just say what will make people happy with you.
Absolutely fascinating. Kelsey Piper, who covers artificial intelligence for Vox News, thanks so much for joining the NewsHour.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Yesterday, we brought you the story of Mark Frerichs, a 60-year-old American contractor from Lombard, Illinois, who was kidnapped and held in Afghanistan for 32 months. U.S. officials believe he was taken and held by the Taliban-allied Haqqani group. Mark was released in September of 2022. Just before the new year, I went to meet Mark in his hometown for his first and only TV interview. Tonight, in part two, his captivity and his release.
In the complete darkness of the tunnel, I didn't know. I had no way of knowing how many weeks had gone by, how many day or night.
Isolated in captivity, Mark clung desperately to the hope he would one day be freed. He didn't know his government was making a plan to get out of Afghanistan. In February of 2020, just weeks after Mark was taken, Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan Reconciliation under then-President Donald Trump, signed a deal with Taliban leadership in Doha, Qatar. The deal laid out a timetable for full U.S. troop withdrawal by May of 2021. It did not include Mark's release.
We're going to continue to work for the release of detained Americans, including Mark Frerichs.
After taking office, President Biden pledged a September withdrawal. But by August, Taliban forces had reached Kabul and reclaimed it.
What do you think at that moment when you realize they are now in control of the country?
I'm frightened.
Why?
What about me? What about America first? Doesn't that include Americans first?
How do you hang on to hope in a moment like that?
What other choice do you have? You just hope tomorrow's the day. You know, looking back, I don't know how I made it through.
Later in his captivity, Mark says his guards would sometimes share news from the outside world, from a deadly virus spreading around the world to his sister working to free him. He believed nothing.
First thing I thought was this guy wouldn't be privy to that information, because a week prior to that, he asked me if I had a sister.
But in fact, 7,000 miles away in Lombard, Mark's sister Charlene Sikora was doing everything she could to get her big brother out.
He got taken to Khost, and he started out in Kabul.
Charlene went to Washington, lobbied the White House, gave national interviews to call attention to Mark's case.
I cry every now and then at night, and I just think about what he's going through right now. Is he being bathed? Is he being fed? Is he clothed? I mean, is he warm?
No one in the family has done more than you to lead the fight, to keep his name in the headlines, to talk to everyone you could talk to get him free. What was that like for you for the last couple of years?
I just took each day and just did what I needed to do each day.
She worked with the FBI and Justice Department, which put up a $5 million reward for information on Mark. Soon after, she says, the phone call started.
Sunday, 9:53 a.m.
Hello, can you help me at this time, please? We are working for the release of Mr. Mark.
Numbers from Afghanistan calling at all hours, claiming they could help to free Mark. Charlene documented everything.
I have files and files and files of everything, categorized who I talk to each day and our conversations. And now I look back and it's like, wow, I really did a lot. Yeah, it was just each day for 2.5 years.
Today is 28.
She tracked every November hostage video of her brother that made its way to her, four in all.
I've been patiently waiting my release.
While Charlene was fighting for her brother's release, Mark was fighting to stay alive and sane in captivity.
I tried keeping track mentally, but when one day merges into the other, it's difficult. And if sleeping is intermittent, sometimes it'd be like 2 hours and then up for a while and then 2 hours. And sometimes I would sleep a complete night. But part of the harassment part of it was keeping your sleep broken up.
He says the guards spent their time tormenting him, taunting him, beating him, and carrying out mock executions.
They were having fun, like coming in the middle of the night, just young kids, faces all wrapped up like a mummy, kind of creepy, just all you see is two eyes, and coming in and tell me that they're going to kill me. Chained up on the ground, blindfold me, and just kind of surround me, like walking around me, talking and cycling their weapons and everything. And I could feel the barrel next to my ear.
Did you think ever this is the moment that I die?
Oh yeah, I mean I was ready to meet my maker. Just, you know, I was kind of like, would they really do it? It's like, you know, you look at their crazy eyes, and it's like, I think they would probably do it.
Meanwhile, back home, a breakthrough. The Biden administration makes a deal with the Taliban, trading Bashir Nourzai, a convicted Afghan drug lord held in a U.S. prison for 17 years, for Mark. In September, U.S. Special Envoy for Hostage Affairs Roger Karstens flew to Kabul to bring Mark home.
What does he say to you?
I think you're free now or something like that. It was such a surreal moment.
When you came back and you found out that your sister had been leading the efforts to free you, fighting for you every day of those 2.5 years.
Yeah.
What did you think?
That was amazing. I couldn't believe it.
Why not?
I hadn't seen her in 15 years. She's halfway around the world. So I look at her in a whole different way now. You know, I mean, we're a lot closer.
Dear Mark,
Charlene has never before shared with Mark the letters she wrote to him while he was held hostage until today.
We will have great tears of joy getting you home on U.S. soil.
Mark's hometown welcomed him back with open arms. He's reconnected with childhood friends.
It's been a long time, man.
Gone out to restaurants and is back to practicing his magic skills.
Oh, very nice.
But he has a long way to go.
You've only been back just over 3 months, yeah. Right? How are you doing?
Doing good. Main thing is keeping it up physically. I seem to be doing okay. I'm in a relationship, so that's working out good. A lot of support for people knowing what I've been through. And yeah, I'm having intermittent sleep issues. Sometimes I'll just have these feelings come across me of like impending danger, you know, but they pass.
Yeah.
He is starting over in every way. No job, no home, hoping a GoFundMe will help sustain him. His savings and equipment were looted back in Afghanistan. After 32 months in captivity, he doesn't know what's next. But what he does know is he is free.
Mark, your day-to-day life now, though, means you can move around freely.
Yeah.
You can open the door and walk outside. You can look up and see the blue sky above you. It is a world away from your life over the last 2.5 years.
Yeah.
They took 2.5 years of your life from you.
Right.
There's no anger there?
If I harbor resentment or carry on continual feeling of anger, then they've won. Resentment for the past is a waste of spirit. If I don't let this thing go, it's going to just keep festering and festering. I got to just let it out, let it go.
Behind the glamour and acclaim of any successful musician, there often lurks a life filled with travails and challenges that fuel the artist's deepest work. Beth Orton is one such artist. Special correspondent Tom Cachato has this story for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Music's been deeply personal to Beth Orton for as long as she can remember.
It was kind of an obsession. Listening to music, I listened to words and I listened to melodies and I analyzed it, but I never really spoke about it to anyone. When I was little, I played piano, just like up and down, you know, like that, moving around on the keyboard. And it was just something I loved to do, and I would do it for hours. I would just get lost in it. And I tried like piano lessons, but I just got racked, you know, on the knuckles, and I wasn't good at it, so just gave it up.
Did you have a sense that you might do it professionally?
No, none, ever.
When still young, she suffered twin blows she didn't know how to come to terms with.
My mom, when I was 19, she died very suddenly. She had cancer and just, yeah, that was that. And my dad, he died of a heart attack when I was 11. It was hard to know how to feel about that. Like, how long are you allowed to, like, feel something, or how long are you allowed to miss someone?
And how can you even process something at that age?
Well, exactly. And I think that I, didn't. But then, you know, at a certain point, you have to feel it.
Beth Orton says she's finally feeling it on her latest release, Weather Alive, an album described by Pitchfork as immersive, soothing, and communal, and the best work of her career. It's a career some 30 years old now. It began at 22 with a unique mix of folk and electronica, and included two critically acclaimed records before she was 27. She cries your name. As the century turned, she won the Brit Award for Best Female Soloist. The sky looked like the limit, but there was a but. She was numbing pain that was not only emotional, but physical. Her fans didn't know she'd been suffering since she was a teenager with the painful gastrointestinal malady, Crohn's disease.
And when you made those records in the 90s, were you in a lot of physical pain?
I was in agony. You said you'd stay forever. And I would just get on stage and I would do what I had to do, and then I would get off stage and I would just do what I had to do to numb it. There were tours that had to be cancelled. There was opportunities that I had to, like, be in a hospital ward and be told that I wasn't allowed to do. The interesting thing about having parents is that you know, there's a lot of stuff that goes by the by when you don't have that kind of support system. And if you have a chronic illness and you don't have a support system and you're kind of being really successful, but you're also under a lot of pressure to be more successful because you're not quite successful, but you are on the cusp of something, it's just like, boom, you don't know where you are.
She says a change began to come when she became a parent herself, with a daughter in 2006 and then a son in 2011.
And the funny thing is, when I had kids, I guess I got emotional sobriety, or tried anyway. I hadn't really learned the kind of skills of being a human.
She's been honing those skills for a decade or so, which also led her toward the raw, image-laden songwriting on Weather Alive. Lay on your back, I just might have spent
trees. And lost in life, and I'm fractals agree. This is the record of someone who's waking up to their own life.
The song Weather Alive speaks to being overwhelmed by nature's majesty. Ooh, it's so pure.
but I very much wrote a much more sensory exploration. For example, you're walking in a mountain and the light suddenly bursts through, you know, you get to the top and the light does what the light does sometimes, you're like, oh my goodness. And like, what would it be to write about that? What is that feeling?
Another song, called Lonely, finds the singer questioning her absent parents about her future.
And I ask my pa, so will I be? I look at my children now at like 11 and 15, how little they are. When I was 11, I was like, you know, out having to kind of like be an adult when I wasn't an adult.
When you do something that is that emotionally open, what's it like sharing your music with your kids? I can imagine your kids listening to that song going, gee, mom sounds like she's pretty lonely.
But I mean, that's taking it a bit literally. I mean, obviously I do sing Lonely about 100 times in that song, but it is one of the biggest kind of achievements in life is to be all right alone, is to be all right lonely, is to embrace all of that stuff. But you ask the children, well, my son does sometimes come in. He did say this line. He said, Mommy, sometimes when you sing, it does sound like you're crying.
It sounds like your son was actually beginning to experience something of what art is.
Yeah, exactly.
30 years on, Beth Orton appears more comfortable than ever with what her art is, and she has some wisdom to impart about it as well.
Just do what you do. Get out of the way of your own process. Create from the truest part of yourself. And then I start sounding like a self-help book, but I mean, there's a reason all those self-help books get written, I suppose, because it's true.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Tom Cachotto in Montclair, New Jersey.
Finally tonight, we remember poet Charles Simic, who died yesterday. He was a prolific writer, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, and served as Poet Laureate of the United States, an honor made all the more remarkable by the fact that he came to this country in his teens. He often wrote with both bite and humor of the World War II era, of his childhood in Serbia, as well as his early years in communist Yugoslavia. He spoke about all of this to Jeffrey Brown at his home in New Hampshire in 2007.
I used to joke, I used to say, Hitler and Stalin, it's thanks to them that I became an American poet.
The sense of history is everywhere in your writing, in your poetry and in your prose.
I remember I wrote once a poem about the Bosnian War in the 90s, and there was caught a little bit of sort of footage of a woman with two little kids, and she's running down the road, some road, God knows who she is or where she's going. I said, well, this is me and my mother and my brother running, and it just repeats itself. So yes, I mean, poet is the one, my kind of poet is the one who notices such things.
Charles Simic was 84 years old, and you can find much more online, including Jeff Brown's full interview with Simic, that is at pbs.org/newshour.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. Join us again here tomorrow night, where we'll have more on Americans installing heat pumps in hopes of reducing their utility bills and helping the planet. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.